From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about America's Black Holocaust and how it lives on today. Then we meet the owner of Sap Sap, whose Lao-inspired cuisine shares his family story.
We're asking them more questions and just understanding like the whole scope of what they went through, the adaptation coming to America. That inspired like the whole Sap Sap, the whole Mama's Egg Rolls, and I was like, we could really do something with this and share our story through the food.
Plus, games expert Jim Lauder talks about how the coronavirus pandemic has impacted the gaming world.
For gaming, this happened in the middle of a transition that was already going on. There was already a migration to online gaming that was happening in tabletop, and this has accelerated it.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. When we hear the word Holocaust, we tend to think of Nazi Germany. But a local organization known as America's Black Holocaust Museum invites us to look at that word and concept in a different light. The museum was founded by Dr. James Cameron, a lynching survivor who dedicated his life to advancing the rights of Black Americans and preserving the history of this community. The head griot of the museum, Reggie Jackson, says the Black Holocaust isn't in the distant past. Instead, it's a part of our past, our present, and most likely our future. Jackson joins me to talk about our nation's past and how current events play into America's Black Holocaust. Reggie Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Joy. Thanks for having me back.
I think there's a lot of confusion over a variety of terms that we now almost exclusively use to reference World War II. And one of the biggest ones seems to be Holocaust, which is often just used to reference the systematic killing of Jews and other groups of people by the Nazis. But Holocaust has a meaning that extends beyond that. How do you define this term?
Well, you know, one of the things I don't think people understand about the word is that it's a very old word. It's been around for a long time, and kind of the original meaning was kind of defined by how the Romans and Greeks used to conquer people. So what they would do is they would, you know, have their armies beat you down, and then they would force men from those communities to join their army by basically just burning down everything that was left of your community. So it originally came into being as a word that described total destruction, usually by fire. And even the way that it's used to describe the murder of 6 million Jews during the period leading up to and during World War II, the Jewish community didn't use that word Holocaust for many, many years. And then it became popular, and that's the only word you typically hear people utilize. So it's an old word that can mean a lot of things in a lot of different circumstances. But I think depending on which community you're from, you're going to define it differently.
When we're talking about America's Black Holocaust, how are we using that word for the experience that Black Americans have had in the United States, really since before it was founded?
Well, you know, the way Dr. Cameron intended for the word to be used, the founder of the museum, just a little background on why he gave it the name that he gave it, I think, is really instructive. So in 1979, he and his wife, Virginia, went on a trip with their church to the Holy Land. And when they were in Jerusalem, they visit Yad Vashem, which is a Jewish Holocaust memorial there. And so as they were in the latter part of Yad Vashem, the last section that you would see at that time was a garden called the Garden of the Righteous Gentiles. And this was dedicated to the memory of all of those people from other communities outside the Jewish community that accepted and really helped to save the lives of Jews from the Nazis. And so they dedicate this memorial there to those individuals. And so as he and his wife, Virginia, were standing in that Garden of the Righteous Gentiles, he turned to Virginia And he said, Virginia, we need a museum like this in America that tells the story of Black people and those freedom-loving whites that were along with us on our journey to find freedom and justice in America. And so that's why he came up with the name for the museum that he did. And so his mission was to simply tell the story of the lives of Africans and their descendants in this country, going back to the time when the first kidnapped Africans were brought to America in 1619, all the way up to and including things that are occurring in our community today, the continued racism and discrimination that we faced. You know, we tell people that it's an ongoing struggle, that the Black Holocaust is not something from the past. It's something that's past, present, and future as well, because these things are not going to be resolved in any short measure of time. They will continue to be a part of our lived experience for the foreseeable future.
Well, and that gets to really the questions I have about the movement that we're seeing right now and the many things that spurred this current movement. So when we look at America's Black Holocaust, what are some of the things that we include inside of that that have fed into this larger cultural movement that we're seeing right now?
Well, when you look back and you understand that there were 246 years that Black people were enslaved in this country legally, and part of the process of enslaving African people was to make sure that they stayed in their place. So there were patrols that were set up throughout colonial America in different colonies, Virginia, Massachusetts, all these different places, to control the enslaved African population. And these patrols were known as slave patrols. And eventually, over the course of time, as they continued to grow and develop, they became the first organized police departments in America. And that relationship between Blacks and police that was so bad back in those days has kind of continued, for the most part, unabated since back in those years when those slave patrols became police departments. The Black community has always seen the police in general as more of a force to control their community than a force to protect their community. And so when we think about those things, we think about what Jim Crow segregation laws did. You know, Jim Crow wasn't just about separating people physically. It was also about controlling the movements of Black people. And those laws and the way that the police were used to control Black people's movement, Black people's access to certain spaces was a big part of this continuing struggle that we have to this day. And obviously, over a long period of time, even after, you know, Jim Crow was seemingly defeated, we have had real issues between police departments around the country and Black communities. And when you look at the civil unrest that people refer to as riots throughout the 1960s in particular, what people don't know because they haven't studied those events is that almost all of those, you know, two dozen or so incidents of civil unrest that were studied by the Kerner Commission report showed that almost all of them were sparked by police activity of some sort. Police did something that really kind of set off the unrest within Black communities around the country, whether it be killing someone, beating someone, some type of ill treatment. And that's very similar to what we're seeing today. You know, the murder of George Floyd set off protests around the country, which in many respects are no different than the protests that occurred in Milwaukee after Dontre Hamilton was killed by a police officer, or after Ernest Lacey was killed by a police officer back in 1981, or what happened in Baltimore after Freddie Gray died in police custody, or what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, when Mike Brown was killed by police, and no different than what's happened in Kenosha with the shooting in the back of Jacob Blake. So all of these things are directly tied to the same issue, that we have an issue with the way police treat Black people. And, you know, it's one of those things where we have seen it so often, Joy, over the last 6 years or so, so many viral videos that have really sparked protests, that I think when the events with George Floyd happened, and also the news of Breonna Taylor, which there's no video of that, but the news of Breonna Taylor being killed in Kentucky, and also the event that led to the death of Ahmaud Arbery at the hands of white vigilantes who claimed they were, you know, making a citizen's arrest, all of those things kind of combine together to really spark something that's very unique in terms of the diversity of the people who are protesting. You know, we've always had white allies in this fight, but this particular time, the number of whites involved in the protests has grown exponentially. You know, I joke with people that when I heard that people were protesting in Fargo, North Dakota and Salt Lake City, Utah, I'm like, well, that has to be white people because there's no black people living out in those places, right? And so, you know, that's the big difference. But I think part of what's been lost in these conversations is that even though the protests started as a result of police activity, they have expanded to include systemic racism, and all of the things that go along with that are really part of the conversations, are part of the things that protesters are asking for, not just reform of police, not just, you know, defunding of police and things of that nature, but they're asking for real work to be done to dismantle systemic racism and all of its ways that it works in our society, within our healthcare system, our criminal justice system, you know, our educational system. People are really demanding things above and beyond things related just to policing.
You know, for people who might have difficulty seeing these links, I think a lot of the time when we get into conversations about even the civil rights movement, but going back to slavery, there are a lot of people who say, well, that was the past. That happened long ago. But as you've pointed out in this conversation, a lot of the things that we're dealing with today are things that continually occur throughout our history. How do you connect these through lines for people who fundamentally can't see them?
Well, I think part of it is that people can't see them, and another part is people don't want to see them. You know, when people say that, well, you know, slavery was a long time ago, why are we still talking about slavery? That was way back in the day, right? And I said, well, you're still talking about the Revolutionary War. You're still talking about the founding fathers, and they were a long time ago. You're still talking about the Mayflower. So if you can talk about the pleasant things about American history, how come you can't talk about the ugly parts that were a long time ago? And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to understand that we've all been cheated in our history classes. Everybody that goes to America's educational system has been cheated by our history being taught in the way that it is. And I understand why it's taught the way it is. It's taught the same way every country teaches history, to make people patriots and lovers of their country. And so you leave out all of the ugly parts. But what it does in America in particular is that it leaves deficits of understanding of how we got to where we are. And people can't draw the connections between this consistent line of discrimination and racism against Blacks that has never ended. It started with slavery, and it has continued through every period of American history up to and including today. There's been an unbroken line of racism. And just because you don't know anything that happened after the Civil War ended and the 13th Amendment was drawn up, and you don't know anything about that period up until Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in 1955, that doesn't mean that bad things didn't happen to Black people. That just simply means most Americans don't know about those things, or they know very little. So people aren't able to think of Jim Crow as anything other than some ugly signs, and they don't, you know, have the ability to understand that, okay, there were thousands of people who were lynched. Most of them were Black. In public spectacle lynchings with tens of thousands of white individuals partaking in those and taking souvenirs such as photographs, body parts, you know, pieces of the lynching rope, bark off of the trees. All of those things are part of American history that you didn't learn in school. We learn about what people refer to as race riots in the 60s and in the 90s after Rodney King, but we don't learn about all of the race riots where white people were the perpetrators in the early 1900s, in 1906 in Atlanta, 1908 in Springfield, Illinois, all around the country. So when we learn American history in a way that we're supposed to, we're able to connect those dots ourselves. We don't need anybody to connect the dots. But because a majority of Americans, including myself, through our K-12 education and even through college, don't learn these things, then it's really almost impossible to connect the dots and understand that the vestiges of slavery are still alive and well because of the mindset that was created at that time, that Blacks were inferior to whites. and that whites in many respects still have institutions that make sure that blacks are treated as an inferior community within our society. It's built into the systems and the institutions within our country. This racism is embedded in those institutions. It doesn't matter who's in the institutions, who's running the institutions. This idea is embedded. And so the results of those institutions, the impact is always going to be the same.
Well, and that gets to this question, you know, when we talk about the Black Holocaust and when we talk about what is currently happening in our country as being a continuation of this Holocaust, it's hard to imagine a future where we aren't still dealing with the remnants of this really baked into our system. Do you see a future in this country where we are able to reckon with our past in a way that we can move on from it?
Well, Joy, I have to be honest and say that I haven't seen a great deal of evidence that we'll ever be that particular America, that we'll ever reckon with the past, because we're still refusing to teach these things. We're still refusing to talk about them when we learn about them. We're still fighting against a system that doesn't want us to teach that part of American history. Just in the past week, you know, President Trump told the Office of Management and Budget to tell every federal agency that they're no longer allowed to have anti-racism training, that it's un-American. So here we have a system where we're fighting tooth and nail to raise awareness of systemic racism, to help to mitigate it in some way by teaching people these things. And we have a federal government now which will not allow federal agencies to talk about these things. And so as long as we continue to live in a society that refuses to acknowledge the errors of its past, refuses to acknowledge the ugliness, then you're never going to see changes happen. We could follow the lead of Germany, which said that we're not going to allow anybody who grows up in Germany to not learn about the Holocaust. We could learn from South Africa, which said we're not going to allow any child to be raised in this society without understanding the history of apartheid in this country, because they understand that you can't get past these ugly parts of your history unless you acknowledge them first. And America has never, ever in its history acknowledge these things. Generally, when they're talked about because Black people and Latinx people and Asian American people and Native American people have been the voices raising those issues to the forefront. We're not seeing these current protests because white people all of a sudden woke up and said, oh, we've been horrible to Black people. Let's do something different. We're waking up to these protests because Black people are fed up. And they have been fed up and continue to be fed up. And they're raising their voices to make people aware of those things. And you're not going to fix these problems overnight, Joy. It's going to take a significant amount of time and effort. And that's if people are willing to do the hard work. I say that it's great that white people are woke right now. But I ask, are you going to get out of the bed and do the real work? Waking up is great. But are you going to be really willing to do the hard work of taking an honest look in the mirror and saying that, yes, America is a nation founded on racism, and then address those things moving forward to alleviate them?
Yeah. Well, Reggie Jackson, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
Yeah, you know, it's a pleasure, Joy. I thank you every time you have me on. And, you know, my work as the head griot at America's Black Holocaust Museum, you know, that volunteer position, I've been talking about these issues literally for almost 20 years now. And, you know, I'll continue to talk about these issues in that capacity moving forward, because I think it's an incredibly important part of the repair and reconciliation that we need as a nation. So thank you for the opportunity.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum and the co-founder and lead trainer of Nurturing Diversity Partners. You can find more of our previous conversations at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we meet the owner of Sap Sap to learn more about his take on Lao cuisine and the power of food. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The word sapsap, directly translated from Laotian, means delicious, delicious. And sapsap owner Alex Hanasakta strives not only for good taste, but community outreach. Hanasakta learned the traditions of Lao cooking from his parents, who used food as a way to connect with neighbors when they settled in Burlington, Wisconsin, after fleeing Laos as war refugees. His company SapSap was founded in 2015 as an expansion of its predecessor Mama's Egg Rolls. And Hanasakta continues to utilize the power of food to build community through wholesale products as well as curbside pop-ups in partnership with local nonprofits. Hanasakta joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about his family's story and starts by describing his take on Lao cuisine.
We're kind of like, I hate the word fusion, but we kind of put flavors from Laos into some of our meals, but sometimes we do serve like authentic stuff. But the description of Lao food would be like really earthy, fishy, fresh, herbaceous or herby, like a lot of fresh herbs, a lot of fresh vegetables. And one thing that separates Lao cuisine than other like Southeast Asian countries is we're known for this super concentrated fish sauce called badak. So you get your filtered versions, and we make a non-filtered version where it sounds like it would smell funky. It kind of does, but it actually has this like really sweet, like herbaceous smell to it. So it's like a super concentrated anchovy paste essentially that doesn't smell weird, even though it's rotten fish in there.
Well, we'll take your word for it since we can't really translate that over radio.
Yeah.
But, you know, it sounds like with the ingredients, the flavor profiles, you know, there's also comes a tradition of farm foraging, using fresh local ingredients. And then you carry this out through your daily operations, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the herbs we get, the veg we use, the roots we use, you can't really find them at your local grocery store. Some Asian markets carry them, but I'm still very lucky to have my mom around, and she has like this huge kaffir lime leaf tree. So I go over there whenever I need it. She's taught me a lot on, you know, what mushrooms that she knows of that are so good, from leeks to chives to, you know, whatever grows around the area that she has experience with. The cool thing about this saw is we've been doing this for so long. I didn't even know it was cool until I got into the food world, right? Like my friends would always be like, what are your parents doing foraging? Like, what the hell is that? So growing up, it was interesting seeing kind of like that cultural difference growing up in Burlington, Wisconsin, because we were kind of like a refugee family that brought back foraging and gardening and, you know, processing their own animals right in their backyard. So we kind of brought that over here with us in the States.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about your family and your father in particular, about what brought you as refugees to Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you're familiar with the secret war in Laos, but during the Vietnam War, there was another war going on in Laos, kind of like a civil war with the Pathet Lao and the Royal Lao Army. My dad fought with the Royal Lao Army, which was the side that the Americans fought with, essentially. So they were backing the Americans in the war. As soon as America pulled out, you know, everyone was meant to fend for themselves. So like the Royal Lao Army, the people that fought alongside Americans were kind of, you know, I hate to say taken advantage of, but they were on a hit list to be, whether it was a re-education camp or they were going to be executed. So my dad escaped to Thailand in one of the refugee camps called Uban. And that's where I was born, in Uban, Thailand. The oldest aunt in my family, my mom's sister, came to the States first. And she got us a sponsor from Burlington, Wisconsin, to sponsor us to come over here. That's why we ended up in Burlington.
You know, I imagine your family, I'm sure, faced a lot of prejudice against Asians, especially after Vietnam War, an obvious language barrier, being shifted from one refugee place to another. And yet your parents and your family found a way to connect with people. So how did your dad and your mother's love of food and their hands-on approach and watching them, how did that shape your view?
Yeah, I mean, it was literally the thing that was a positive being around like our community, because it was like low income families, predominantly Caucasian, low income. So there was a lot of racism going on. But every time my mom would make these egg rolls, like, they loved her. So that was kind of like the, you know, the starter of it all, the conversation starter. And so we were known for having really good egg rolls. So that opened up the conversation to, what are you guys? Where do you guys come from? What happened? So it was that, you know, the food alone had so much power behind like our communication with our neighbors.
And did you find yourself always immersed in helping your parents in the kitchen? You know, a lot of immigrant families or refugee families, the children kind of have sometimes a desire to stray away from it or be Americanized or turn away from their traditional foods to not be judged. How did you view that growing up?
I hated it, to be honest. You know? Well, we would cook chickens. I mean, we would process it, a chicken in our own kitchen, and it was embarrassing. Because all our neighbors, like, what the hell? This is what you do for your childhood, you know? It was weird because we had no other Lao neighbors that we could communicate that with. I mean, they were all up in the north side of Milwaukee or Elgin or Rockford, but we had no neighboring Lao neighbors. But yeah, it was weird, like trying to explain what we do, why we do it that way. There'd be like plucked chickens in the sink, and my neighborhood friends would be like, "What the hell is that?" And I, you know, it's chicken, but it's like we just process it by ourselves rather than get it from the store.
So how did you go from hating how your family prepped food to now it's your livelihood? It's the way you connect with others.
Yeah, I guess when you're a kid, you don't really think about that besides being cool, right? So as I got older, I realized like everything started connecting. Everything started making more sense to me of why we were here. Even when I was a kid, I didn't even really know why we were here. Because I remember my dad always saying, "This isn't our home, this isn't our home." And I'd always be like, "Then where is home?" But as I got older, I started questioning more and like starting doing more research with my parents or asking them more questions and just understanding like the whole scope of what they went through, the adaptation coming to America. That inspired like the whole Sap Sat, the whole Mama's Egg Rolls. And I was like, we could really do something with this and share our story through the food.
And your dad especially taught you a lot about the power of food when it comes to building community. So can you tell us a bit about his story?
So he was actually pretty well known in Laos. So he was really well respected. So he was one of the first people that came here, and he helped a bunch of people come here from Laos, help them get acclimated, help them get their driver's license. We always have like a, we say uncle, but he was not really blood related that lived with us. So we'd always have one of those guys like stay at our house, and my dad would help them get on their feet. And we always had a rotating door, people coming in left and right just to get on their feet. And my dad would take them in. As far as our neighbors, my dad, again, like it was food. He'd communicate through food. He barely spoke English, so it was always weird, like seeing my dad sit with our neighbor, just like like trying to communicate, but they'd sit for hours having beer and food. So,
well, and your dad, as a veteran, he was never seen as that since he was, or at least in the U.S. because he wasn't officially part of U.S. Armed Forces. And he struggled with the same things, PTSD, et cetera, that a lot of Vietnam vets did. And seeing that growing up, or maybe recognizing what he was going through as you got older, how did that affect what you're trying to do today? Because you do a lot of partnerships, and it's much more than about cooking and selling food for you.
I mean, that's working with the VOW, the Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. That was like kind of seeing what my dad went through was the inspiration behind that. Seeing what he went through with his PTSD and not getting the help, just seeing it firsthand what someone goes through was so powerful for me to try to help out the best I can with the veterans in at Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. And these are, they're just not veterans, right? They're just not people that signed up and didn't go to war. And they're actually people that went through combat, saw some crazy stuff, came back here and went through some more crazy stuff. So they're like homeless veterans, and they're not like, you know, someone that just signed up for the army that never went to service. Like, these guys actually went through hell and back.
Partnering with Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin and connecting through what perhaps an outside perspective would view as opposing sides, considering the climate that each of the veterans went through. How do you find that connecting this way helps not just them, but you. You know, do you have memorable interactions that continue to fuel why you're doing this?
Well, I just go off my experience, you know, seeing the power of food as a young kid, kind of break down barriers and start conversations. Seeing my dad do it, like our neighbor was like an old Vietnam vet too, and he just thought we were all Viet Cong until my dad really broke down the story to him, you know, and as cliche as it sounds, it all started with a bite of food.
With SAPSAP, you were just about getting ready to open a brick and mortar location, and then of course the coronavirus pandemic hit. So you've since pivoted to curbside out of a shared kitchen space in Racine, and from the looks of it, have really made the best out of a massive roadblock. How, you know, at first, how did you take having to shift this way, and how has your perspective changed to dealing with the needs of the immediate future right now?
Yeah, it was weird. We didn't know what to expect. We were actually gonna, we were doing a trial at Crossroads Collective in Milwaukee, and that's when COVID hit. So like we invested all this money, then COVID happened. And I was like, what do I do now? You know, I have to make some kind of money, lost some money with Crossroads. So yeah, ultimately we gave it a shot. We didn't, I was like, I have a restaurant license here. Why don't we just do curbside and try it out? And ever since then it kind of took off, and it wasn't even planned to take off like that. So we were just rolling with the punches with the momentum, and things got a little crazy as far as execution, but we adapted. And right now, looking forward, I still don't think I want to open up a brick and mortar. I still like to do curbside because you never know what's happening with COVID. And just for the safety of our fans, like we don't want any interactions with any people coming in. So we're just trying to be safe as we can with our curbside. And we're working on some wholesale projects too. So yeah, that's what we're currently doing right now.
Do you think you would have been able to have the same impact or opportunities that you're doing now with partnerships and curbside had, you know, things, quote, gone to plan?
Yeah, it definitely was a positive for sure, the curbside, but like who knows what would have happened with the momentum of our Wisconsin Foodie episode coming out, with, you know, all these projects we had going on and these private dinners we had lined up. So yeah, I mean, I guess you could, it's definitely a positive.
If someone is just learning about your story and, you know, perhaps haven't even had a single dish of Laotian food, what do you want people not just to taste, but to experience when they come and have some of your food?
You know, I want them to, well, one, know like it comes from a lot of struggle. It comes from a deep-rooted history. But I also want them to be like, wow, that is some good, you know, whatever we're making. But more importantly, the message of what happened in Laos, why we're here, why refugees are here. And I think that's really important right now to accept or find similarities more than we do differences in the whole state of things right now. And, you know, I think if we can do that at SAPSAP with food, I mean, I think that's very powerful, that where we came from, why we came from there, and what we're doing right now as a business.
So the foundations of your recipes are from your mother and father and traditional Laotian cuisine, with, of course, a flair of your own input. But what does your mom think of what you've been developing and the growth of SAPSAP today?
She used to be super pessimistic, right? So negative, you know, your quintessential crazy Asian mom. Be a lawyer, be an engineer, and I'd totally not fall in those shoes. But no, she's pretty excited about the media we're getting, the business we're doing, just the attention we're getting. It boggles my mind too, because like I never expected for us to get all this attention and do so well. We're working with other great people, like we're working with Jennifer Casey from Fondy's Farmers Market. I just met with her, and we were part of their annual dinner and meeting all the great chefs there. I mean, even stuff like that, like meeting new friends and opening up new doors, it's very cool for me.
Alex Hanasakta is the owner and lead developer of SAPSAP. Their latest curbside pop-up will take place tomorrow in collaboration with the Iron Grate Barbecue Company in Milwaukee. The event will help raise funds for Hungry Hearts Community Meals. We'll take one last break, then learn how the pandemic has reshaped the gaming world. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM.
Thank you.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When people started quarantining and social distancing as the coronavirus pandemic took hold, we all looked for ways to have fun at home. And many of us have turned to gaming. There has been a huge increase in people using game apps. Jackbox Games, a virtual gaming platform, has also seen a major increase in usage. And other games like Animal Crossing have become an outlet for digital social interaction. But what about games like Cards Against Humanity or Settlers of Catan? Unless you're living with other people, tabletop games aren't safe to play right now. So many companies have moved board games to digital platforms to meet current demands. Writer and games expert Jim Lauder spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about these trends. He begins by explaining that the pandemic didn't necessarily spur the remote gaming movement.
It's an interesting time, obviously, for everyone, but for gaming, this happened in the middle of a transition that was already going on. There was already a migration to online gaming that was happening in tabletop, and this has accelerated it.
And with video games and tabletop games, but we can focus on video to start. Before this happened, video games often had a negative stereotype of gamers just on their consoles for 8+ hours a day, but now it serves as a way to interact with new people on that platform. So do you think video gamers have kind of come out ahead and kind of, maybe not a I told you so moment, but just have had their moment of glory, I suppose?
Well, gaming, like a lot of things that were geek media, superheroes and comics and those kind of things, have become sort of the main culture over the last decade or so. And Dungeons and Dragons and video games have become more accepted. As they've developed, they've also expanded out to a wider audience. So they're more acceptable now when your mom might be playing Animal Crossing. It's easier to get her to understand why you want to play Red Dead or you want to play another game yourself for a while.
On the note of Animal Crossing, that saw a huge uptick with over 5 million digital copies sold in such a short amount of time.
Staggering. And in a lot of ways, Animal Crossing is one of those games you either get or you don't. It is, in a lot of ways, doing digital chores. So you're weeding and planting flowers and doing all the other stuff that actually you really don't want to do in your real life for the most part. But it's also a way to build community and people visit each other's. You go through in the game and you set up an island and you have virtual visitors, but you can actually also have real visitors. So you put your code out there and people can come and visit your island and get things from your island that they can't get from their own. And it becomes a way to, I think the two positives that come out of a game like Animal Crossing, one is you have a feeling that you control your environment, which is very important right now. If you feel like you can build these things and they're going to be there and you can make your island what you want it to be, that idea of control is reassuring. And it also builds community, because then you can share that island with other people and share it with other players who you may not see ever, but they'll come and visit your island.
Along the lines of trivia, usually that's something that you go to a bar or a restaurant. It's an interactive group activity. But now that is also being moved online with either trivia-specific platforms or Jackbox games is also another thing that people have probably played almost every single gaming auction to.
Well, and that's, everything at this point is figuring out a way to present the experience virtually in a way that captures what appeals to players in real life. Because part of the appeal of tabletop over video games or trivia games over just playing trivia games as a video game is that community, is that idea that you're interacting with people face to face.
Do you know of any online platforms that have gained more traction because it's a little more user-friendly to transition people from being used to being, playing tabletop games and being surrounded by people to now we have to shift, and there's a little bit of a learning curve with that?
There is, and the games play very differently virtually than they play in person. the best example that I know from my own experience is when you run a role-playing game at a convention, the block of time that you normally would set out would be about 4 hours. And everybody around the table will play through this scenario in 4 hours. And that's a comfortable time for everyone to play. It's a lot shorter virtually. Really, you're talking about 2 or 2.5 hours because you don't have the same experience as sitting next to somebody at a table or having that physical presence to keep you engaged. If you're just staring at a screen for 4 hours, that's a little long, but you can play a role-playing game in 2 hours and break them up into 2-hour sessions. That's much more successful.
So how are those structured? Because with RPGs, I imagine that these kind of games face the most significant challenge because you have a group of, you know, anyone from 3 to maybe under 10 people. You have a dungeon master, if we're going to use Dungeons and Dragons as an example. So DM's running the game. Normally you wait everyone's turn to roll their dice, talk to each other, kind of strategize what's your next steps to do. So, you know, do you find that translates?
It can. I mean, and there are different platforms. The way I've been running Call of Cthulhu scenarios through Zoom, and because I don't use a lot of miniatures or other props like that, it's worked very well. I use handouts, but you can always just send those through private messages as attachments. Make it a PDF and you can send it where you might hand somebody a piece of paper during the game. Other styles of role-playing face more challenges, but there are platforms like Roll20 and a couple of other platforms that are specifically set up as virtual tabletops that have maps, mapping software as part of the package that include things where you can customize tokens to make it more personal for your players, that they feel like that token on the board is theirs the way they would a miniature if they were playing in real life. Those sorts of things have been very successful, and there are a number of those now that have grown in popularity wildly since people have started playing remotely.
So were they already established somewhat before the pandemic hit and now people flooded to it?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's what I had mentioned earlier about the fact that role-playing games especially had been transitioning more to online play, in part because of the way streaming has impacted the community at large too. More people are watching things like Critical Role and accessing role-playing games that way. So they are a little more comfortable playing virtually as well, because that's how they're experiencing the game the first time themselves. That transition to online was already becoming a component, and this has definitely sped it up.
This season, we're coming up on a lot of conventions that are either being canceled or postponed, including gaming convention season, and you're especially active in that. So what role do these serve normally, you know, quote, normally under normal circumstances, and how do you foresee this impacting gaming in the long run, or do you think it's something that can recover pretty quickly?
Well, we'll have to see how long it will take for things to recover. Gaming conventions are a big part of the hobby and a big part of the community. They serve multiple purposes. On the one hand, they're from people who work in the industry, they're trade shows. So you go and interact with colleagues, you have meetings with publishers, you talk about the plans for the products that you're going to be doing over the next year, things like that. And it's the place where you meet people you may have known for decades, but you see them once a year or twice a year at these shows. For the hobbyists, it's a way to learn about new games, to try new games. There are a lot of people who go to conventions and play demo games that publishers set up. Publishers will then pitch their new products or provide entry-level games for older games to give the community a chance to access them. But there are also places where the gaming community interacts with each other. So you go and you sign up for a game of Dungeons and Dragons or Call of Cthulhu or Cyberpunk for a role-playing game, or Ticket to Ride or Settlers of Catan for a board game, and you'll sit down at the table with people you've never met. And what you have in common with them is the game. And it's a way to expand your community and to interact with people through something you love. And all of that has gone away. And so Gen Con just canceled. That's been happening since 1967. 1968 was Gen Con 1, 1967 was Gen Con 0 and Gary Gygax's porch down in Lake Geneva. And that has grown to 70,000 people. And this will be the first time since 1967 that there was not an in-person Gen Con. Spiel in Germany, the Essen Game Fair, that's 200,000 people. It's the largest board game convention in the world. They also canceled because there's no way to do these because they're about social interaction. They're about sitting at tables with people. They're about interacting with publishers at booths. There's really no way to do them in the current situation safely. So the conventions have been very responsible. GameOlCon in Madison as well. Now, the thing that's interesting is all of these shows, the game focus shows like Gen Con, Origins, Game Hole, and Madison, are looking at ways in which to offer some kind of virtual component as a replacement. And we haven't really run through any of those larger ones yet, so we haven't seen how virtual Gen Con is going to work. GaryCon ran a virtual replacement for that convention back in March, and that went pretty well, but it was not anywhere near the size of 70,000 people who would normally be at Gen Con.
Do you find that more people are then being more interactive on these online platforms than their normal behavior would have been, you know, just to focus on their game, interact with people for the sake of strategy? Is there more connection happening outside of that now?
There is, and that's actually, if you look at positives that are coming out of all of this, the people who are playing games on Zoom now who are able to connect with people that maybe they didn't game with for a long time because they live too far away. I'm actually planning to run a Call of Cthulhu game for several people from my high school gaming group who I haven't played with since the early 80s, which it's going to be awesome. It doesn't matter how the game goes, it'll still be. And that's because I have been learning how to run games on Zoom. And it was because of the pandemic and because this is part of my job, I needed to figure out how this worked. That's opened up that opportunity. And that's true for a lot of people. A lot of people have been interacting with even people they don't know, because you can go to some of these platforms if you're looking for a pickup game of D&D or a pickup game of Settlers of Catan. You can go to these online places and find a gaming group to try and play with.
Have you found that family habits and individual gaming habits have also kind of been on the up and up? If, you know, say, for example, gaming is a great way to interact with your kids and still have some sort of lesson in strategy, but not bogger them down with interactive online lessons of school.
Yes, and games are both a wonderful way to interact with people and a good way to get everybody angry, depending on what you're playing. So you have to select your games carefully. You don't want to be playing Cutthroat Caverns or this Diplomacy or something like that, a game that is guaranteed to start arguments when you're going to be locked in the house with those people for possibly weeks or months. But it's also a great way to interact with people and find ways to tell stories together and create memories together that transcend everything else that's going on around you.
Have board game and gaming supply stores been able to adjust with all of this?
Board game stores are facing the same challenges as any other small retailers. Most of the board game stores are small places. They are setting up curbside service where they can. The biggest challenge for the hobby as a whole is the instability of the distribution network and the publishing and printing of games, because it's like any other industry. Any disruption in any of that, from getting your game shipped from point A to point B, getting your games printed, getting your games sent to the warehouse, any of that will mean your game doesn't come out. You can't get to the store. And now with different stores being closed down or having limited hours or having limited access, all of that is challenging. But game stores are trying to adapt, and curbside service and limiting the number of people who are in the store, not running demos or having tournaments where you would have a number of people in the store for hours on end playing together. That's the part that's shifting online, and stores are participating in that as well.
Are there any games, either board games, card games, online games, that you can recommend that can be successfully played over, you know, Zoom or other platforms, even if not all the participants have the same access either to the physical game itself or equipment or things like that? You know, if someone is living on their own and they want to play a board game with their friends, who are usually the place to go to for game night, and, you know, so those kind of situations.
Right, the person with the gigantic shelf of games.
Exactly.
The advantage of the online places are that they tend to then share, everybody has the resources. If the game is available, when you want to play D&D online, D&D online provides the same material at the tabletop to everyone. Places like Tabletopia, which have a number of different board games, like Wingspan, which is a newer game, very popular. They have the online version of Wingspan that you can go and play there. You don't need the game, you don't need the rules, everything is set up. That's also something that places like Roll20 do. They provide tools that might help you with your character sheets. They might, for the role-playing places like Roll20, they include dice, so you can do the dice rolls virtually as well. You don't even need to have the dice at home. And all of those are, if you search for a virtual tabletop online, or if there's a particular game you like to play, if you like to play Ticket to Ride and you want to see where the online community is for that, then search virtual Ticket to Ride and you'll find several options on how to get together in a game.
So do you think any of these new habits will stick of people playing more games together?
I think, especially for the role-playing community, I think that's going to change. I think that's going to stick, because role-playing games in a slightly different form, as I said, that when you're playing at a convention or you're playing in your normal weekly game, 4 to 6 hours wouldn't be unheard of. Those are going to be shorter sessions probably online. But I think that people are discovering that role-playing games, especially because they are essentially group storytelling, work very well virtually.
Excellent. Well, Jim Lauder, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us about how people are adapting with games nowadays.
Thank you very much. Stay safe.
Jim Lauder is a writer, games expert, and editor of the anthologies Hobby Games, The 100 Best, and Family Games, The 100 Best. He spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in July. You can explore our past Games to Gift segments with Lauder at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.